You are listening to This Book I Read, a podcast from Beyond Cataclysm. Hello and welcome to This Book I Read, a podcast from Beyond Cataclysm, where we talk to authors about a book that has stuck with them through the years, for good reasons, or sometimes bad ones. My name is Chris He Him, also known as C.M. Lowry. I read and write sci-fi and recently helped bring out ISBN Coffee. Find out more about me at allaboutchris.org or on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Mastodon, Blue Sky, other things as at CM Lowry Author. However, I'm not important. We're not here to talk about me. This is the moment that we welcome Cecile Cristofari to the show. Hello.
Hello, Chris.
Did I pronounce your name anywhere near correct?
You did. Perfect.
Tell us a little bit more about yourself, Cecile.
I'm a writer. I write science fiction and fantasy short stories primarily. And mostly I write things that tend to be focused on climate change. And I talk a lot about Provence, which is where I am from. And I have a short story collection out from Yukon Press titled Elephants in Bloom.
Indeed, which I own and haven't read yet, but it's on the pile. So if you put it on the pile that you plan to read, that counts as reading it, right? You still get a point.
That counts as reading, yes.
So, Cecile, why are you here?
Alors, je voulais parler d'un livre que j'ai lu.
Yes, so that was French for, well, there's this book I read, probably. Or maybe it was an insult about me in French that I didn't understand. Either way, what book have you brought?
This is a book titled The Accursed Kings by Maurice Druon. It is a huge 2,000 or 3,000 page monster, but I read it in very few sittings because it's absolutely amazing. It's historical fiction and it is about the last of the Capetian kings just before, so that was those were the kings who ruled France just before the Hundred Years' War. And so there is that legend that shortly before the war started, King Philip the Fair was one of the great kings in French history. Trying to get money from the treasury, and so he wanted to get the money from the Templar kings because, well, he had to get the money somewhere, and so he made up this whole sham trial to get them burned at the stake for heresy. And so when the Grand Master of the Templars was burned at the stake, he allegedly cursed King Philip and all his descendants over 13 generations. And that is where the series starts, and hence the title, The Accursed Kings.
And so the book covers the entire series of all 13 kings or Philip?
Well, no, just the few kings that came after King Philip, because it is true that up until then, the dynasty of the Capetians had enjoyed great fortune. Everything was quiet. It was a peaceful time in France. And most importantly, they all had sons, which meant that there never was any kind of war of succession or anything. So for a couple of hundred years, everything went well. And suddenly, right after Philip the Fair's death, all his sons were kings for a very short time, and they all died. in more or less troubled circumstances, and things went downhill rather catastrophically in a few decades. This was the 14th century, so famines and the plague, and also the Hundred Years' War that was about to start, so, which is probably how people ended up believing in that legend of the curse of the Templars. Right. So the book covers the years between, Philip's the Fair's last years and the Hundred Years' War.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's really interesting having you on the show. Anyway, because I find you fascinating as a person. But obviously you're French, and I'm not
yes.
French. I'm English, and so our upbringings. If you had a fairly traditional school kind of experience like I did, I had a very potted history of European history, which mostly seemed to focus on how England were very, very important and sort of ignored everybody else. So like, I've never really heard of King Philip, you know, like as in, and all of our interactions of English and French history are times that we've had wars with France, but generally in a kind of painted in a way of how basically we eventually won, which I'm sure that the French school teaching of those things is probably similar, but in a reverse kind of picture.
Well, yes, it's a little bit different the way we teach it because, well, as far as the French are concerned, France is the greatest country in the world and also the center of the world, and the English are evil, basically. So that's more or less. But the interesting thing is that when you look at that time, well, France and England were more or less the same country.
Yes, definitely. I think there was
really
at that period, I'm not sure of the exact kind of centuries, but definitely around that period, the most common language spoken in the English court, like by all of the nobles,
was French. Yes, indeed. And actually, in the Middle Ages, well, we tend to forget that today, but the definition of what counted as a country or not was rather different from our definition, because of feudalism. So you could have someone who was king of a country, but then you would have nobles in the country who were almost as powerful as the king himself, for example. And you could have a king like the King of England, who was technically supposed to be a vassal of the French king. So technically, they were not on the same level.
We've moved on from that now. Like, our king's incredibly powerful and important now. Like, we're tremendously respectful of King Charles. Like, it's, you know, he does, I think he, you know, occasionally he opens a hospital. I mean, you know, you couldn't do that without incredible power, you know.
Indeed, yeah.
Do you have, I know you have a quote for us from the book. So often, always, in fact, our authors come on and they share a quote from the book. But what I think is fascinating here is you only had a French copy of the book, and this is an English language
yes.
podcast, so you have translated it yourself, which is brilliant.
Yes, so I apologize in advance if it doesn't sound like the actual translated version you can find in a bookshop. But yeah, I couldn't get my hands on an English copy, so I did what I could. I would love to read from, the moment at the beginning of the series when the Grand Master of the Templars curses King Philip and everybody around, because it's quite a spectacular bit. And well, you'll see this is representative of the writing of the book as a whole, which is extremely vivid and elaborate. Anyway, shall I begin?
Yeah.
So the Grandmaster has been tied to the stake, and they have set fire to the stake, and everything is about to go downhill for everybody. Even in that instant, Philip the Fair's large cold eyes wouldn't blink. Then, all of a sudden, the Grandmaster's voice rose through the curtain of fire, and as if he was speaking to each and everyone in the public, he hit each and everyone like a slap. With astonishing strength, as he had done in front of Notre Dame, Jacques de Molay shouted, "Shame, shame, these are innocents you're watching burn.
Shame on you all, God will judge you. The flame scourged him, burned his beard, reduced his paper mitre to cinders in a heartbeat, and lit up his white hair. The terrified crowd had gone quiet. It seemed as if they were burning a mad prophet. From that smouldering face, the awful voice rose again. Pope Clement, Sir Guillaume, King Philip. Within a year, I summon you to God's tribunal, where your punishment will be meted out. A curse on you, a curse on all of you and yours, until the 13th generation of your blood. The flames entered the Grand Master's mouth and smothered his last cry. Then, for what seemed like an eternity, he fought his last against death. Then he yielded, the rope broke, he slumped into the inferno, and the crowd could see his hands still raised between the flames. It stayed that way until it had turned entirely black. And there you go, the Grand Master is gone. Everybody is cursed, and we're going to see if indeed they're all going to die within a year, which of course is what happens.
It's pretty harrowing. I realize now we probably should have put a content warning about seeing some hands slowly turn black in the fire, but it was moving. I am fascinated, well, that you translated it, because one of the challenges that you have in reading books from other cultures is obviously that they have to be translated, and there's a lens that happens by. Have you heard of the book All Quiet on the Western Front?
Yes.
But that quite famously is named that, but really is probably a mistranslation, and it should have been called sort of nothing new in the West, which is a little bit more critical, you know, like it's saying nothing's happening, but also kind of no one's learning, rather than everything's just quiet.
And that's actually how it's been translated into French.
Exactly.
Nothing new in the West. Yes.
And so it's interesting. And there were probably, whether or not it was just bad translation or whether or not there were kind of political decisions about that, or it's those things are fascinating. Going back to the Accursed Kings, what is your favourite thing about the book?
Well, what I really enjoy about this book is that it is, well, it's a book about history, but actually, if you read it closely, it's a book about the French politics of the time when it was written. So it's a book that was written in the 50s and 60s. And, you know, at the time, France had just, well, it was just rising again from its ashes, more or less, because it had a rather close call in the war. And French politics were being rebuilt.
The history that we learned there is that there was a war and that England won the war. That's basically how it works, isn't it? We came and we saved it for the rest of Europe. That's right, isn't it, basically?
Well, that's more or less also what we learned, yes. Okay. Because even the French couldn't.
I think, to be fair, it was the Americans that won the war. But anyway, moving on, back to the 50s. So you've got a French population who are not feeling strong and full at that moment necessarily.
Yeah, not very much. And they were very quickly coming up with all sorts of narratives to explain why they had never collaborated with the Nazis. That was all a horrible misunderstanding, because the real French people were the ones who were with General de Gaulle. You know, so in England precisely, and in France resisting, etc. And France was really fractured at that time, and there were a lot of people, and the people who followed General de Gaulle, and Maurice Druon was among them, actually, because he had been a resistant as well, a resistant. And so these people had lots of thoughts about how what France needed was a great man, you know, to put it back together piece by piece and build something that was at the same time, you know, the real France, the essence of France, and something new. And so when you read The Accursed Kings, it's really interesting because it takes place at a time when France was in shambles. Because, well, the thesis of the book is that it was because the ruling class wasn't doing its job, because they were all in this game for their personal gain and personal power. And they were all in this to make money and didn't care for the people of France. And it's a book that's extremely critical of the ancient regime, so the monarchy, while at the same time showing some of the complexities of that time, and especially the fact that someone like Philippe the Fair, Philippe le Bel, as we say in France, was actually a king who was trying to gain more power, but not because he wanted to be more powerful himself, not necessarily, but because, according to the book, he could see that all the nobles were all fighting to get their hands on more lands and more money and everything. And he wanted to unify France and get rid of all those petty wars that were just, well, destroying the French people. And so, yeah, if you read this book, it's really layered because it's both about French history and the monarchy, and also about modern times, and is very critical of political power.
I don't feel like there's any, there's any relevance to modern times. I mean, Boris Johnson, Nicolas Sarkozy. I can't think of any current corruption or problems in modern society.
Oh, well, that never really happens. No, especially not with capitalism. I mean, capitalism is essentially benevolent, as we all know, and it's
Basically,
never
yeah.
about making more money and to the detriment of the
Oh,
people.
by the way, everyone listening, it now costs £100 to listen to this podcast. Please send your money through to us through Bitcoin, please. That would be great. Yes. So, what? Sorry, I interrupted to make a silly joke. But what comments does it make on modern times then? In it, as it's commenting on 12th century times.
Well, it's really interesting because if you look at the, well, what he chooses to showcase in the book, the kind of politics and the kind of people, well, the whole book is peppered with political cliches of the 20th century. For example, this king who doesn't know how to rule, and so he just keeps repeating, well, we need order, we want order. And, well, this is probably not a medieval thing, but kind of criticism probably of the conservative ruling class, even though Drouot was a conservative himself, actually. But certain cliches of politics at the time, or people re just demanding to see the accounts of the treasurer of the king because they want to prove that he was corrupt. And when he turns out to have perfectly straight, impeccable accounts with no traces of corruption whatsoever, well, they start criticizing the idea that figures mean anything because you can take figures and make them say anything you want. And just exactly the same thing you will hear in politics in, well, in the 50s, but also, let's be honest, today a little bit, give us the
Alternative
figures,
facts and
but
fake news, yeah.
yes, pretty much. So, and yeah, so there is this running commentary on corruption, and yeah, especially on how people can try to appropriate political power for personal gain and make a mess of things. So yes, it's really quite interesting to read it in that light.
How is it as a story? So it's 2,000 pages.
Yes.
It sounds quite dense.
It is, yes. But it's really, well, I think the best comparison is, this book gained some new attention recently because it's actually the book that inspired George Martin to write A Song of Ice and Fire. was one of his major sources of inspiration. And indeed, when you read it, it feels rather similar in a lot of things. Well, there are lots of characters. Well, of course, it's historical fiction. So, yes, everybody who mattered at the time makes an appearance. Lots of characters and lots of people dying out of nowhere just because someone decided to murder them. And yes, you have murders, you have people having affairs with other people they shouldn't be seeing and dying because of that, or making kingdoms collapse because of love affairs or whatever. So it's very, very, it's also extremely vivid. And lots of court intrigue and a little bit also about, it's not just about the nobility, it's also about the common people. And in particular, there is a one recurring character who is an Italian merchant, because there were lots of Italian merchants in France at the time, and he's just going about his business and meeting famous people from the time, and he's not really aware of what's going on in politics. And so you get a broad picture of what French life was like at the time. And so you have to think of a kind of historical Game of Thrones, really.
Which, I mean, I as I recall, there weren't as many dragons in France in the 1400s.
No, that's the part. But there is magic, though, in the book, because there are witches and, well, curses, of course. A little bit.
Is it as brutal as Game of Thrones?
Yes.
Okay. Nice.
I think so. Maybe a little bit less. As I said, the interesting thing is, I think that when I read this book and when George Martin read this book, we were coming from really different backgrounds, right? Because I was reading it with the lens of French history. And George Martin was probably reading it in, well, you know, an entertainment perspective, right? And so I think that you can also read this book as just pure entertainment, wars and intrigue and lots of sex and horrible people who are also really fascinating and larger than life, and not so horrible people, but who still die for no reason, etc. And yes, when you read it as history, well, of course, some of the things really happened. Some did not. Let's be fair. It's not a purely realistic book. But
that is the challenge with historical fiction. The biggest series of historical fiction I've read, and again, it is really interesting because our perspectives on it just may be quite different, because I've read the whole Sharp series by Bernard Cornwell, which is set entirely on the Napoleonic Wars. So it's entirely English people taking down the French.
Yeah.
One of the things I found really interesting, that so Bernard Cornwell is a historian, and in order that his character can be at the heart of every major battle that happens throughout the Napoleonic Wars, he has to bend the truth, you know, and has to make a group of the I think the 95th Rifles they are, and he moves them into battles that they never would have been in order to give them a reason to be there. It's an interesting one, because do you ever worry that it kind of teaches you a form of history in your head that isn't the actual history?
Well, I think that when you read historical fiction, well, my personal take is that you have to read it first as literature and as myth. And then you have to be really careful if you want to take it as history. Because, for example, when you read The Accursed Kings, it's a bit tricky because there are plenty of historical notes, and there was a huge amount of work done. Actually, Maurice Druon didn't work alone. He had plenty of people helping him with the research, and not only great historical events, but also how people lived at the time, how, for example, a marriage ceremony would be like at the time, and the truth about witchcraft trials, things like that. So it sounds like he's telling the truth about history, but actually he's not at all. It's a blend of historical truth and urban legends. For example, there was this legend at the time that one of the accursed kings, who, well, actually died in infancy, so the curse was really strong there, apparently. So there was a legend that this king had been swapped at birth with another infant. And years later, there was a man who showed up in France and said, "Hang on, I'm the real French king. I was exchanged at birth." And of course, nobody really believed it. But in the book, it's true.
Yeah.
You really have babies swapped at birth, etc. But it's not particularly indicated in the notes or anywhere. So yeah, you have to be really, really careful with how you take these novels. But I think the point is not really to teach you about history, it's to teach you about a version of history that fits within a certain version of the national myth.
Is there anything about the book you would change, or that you don't like, or problems?
Let's see. What's really interesting is that, well, Maurice Druon was a member of the French Academy, you know, so it's that institution that decides what counts as proper French. So that means, well, basically the requirements to get into the French Academy are that you need to know people on the inside and be really reactionary and write excellent French in that order, more or less. So yeah, so he was a bit of a reactionary, really, really conservative, really critical of, for example, civil rights movements in the 60s, etc. But when you read this book, it's a rather more ambiguous picture. For example, he's really surprisingly compassionate to women characters and to gay characters, which is even more surprising given the time at which it was written. So for our times, from our perspective, he's not what you would expect of a reactionary right-winger.
Writing in the
50s. Something.
Yeah.
Yes, it's not at all what you would imagine. At the same time, he has this really strong thesis that what a country really needs is a strong man who has the good of the country at heart, etc. And that's, a little bit problematic, because the entire series is about how, when you have a strong man at the head of the state, everything goes well, and when you don't, things go badly. And from there to saying that what we really need is a good dictator to tell everybody what's right, you know, there's a very fine line. And he doesn't actually cross it, which is interesting. Because when Philippe the Fair and his advisor, his main advisor, die, they both acknowledge that they did bad things in the name of the greater good, and that it's not completely okay, and probably they're being punished by God for that. So it remains quite complex, but still there is this whole philosophy of, you know, this idea that what history needs is great men. And Well, not only do I disagree with that quite a lot, but also I think when you start saying things like this, 10 minutes later, you're saying that what the country really needs is less democracy and a bit more.
And it's an interesting point to take, writing in the war-ravaged 1950s France, post the great dictator happening just over the border. If people have like the idea of this book, or they get on well with it, and any other suggestions you have for other books they could read?
I think historical fantasy in general is really is a really interesting genre to look into, because historical fiction is great, but as we said, the thing is it can get a bit confusing sometimes, because you may expect it to tell you the truth, about history, and very often it doesn't. So I rather enjoy historical fantasy because it doesn't pretend that it's going to tell you the truth about anything.
Yeah.
And paradoxically, sometimes it can develop a rather complex discourse around history and historical events, not necessarily by telling you exactly what happened, but by telling you what should logically happen in this or that circumstance.
I think the fantasy element can be really good. So, for example, if we said, well, what would have happened in France in the 14th century if suddenly loads of dragons had arrived? You can still explore lots of the aspects of the culture and stuff like that. But you're also, no one's going to think, oh, this is definitely what happened. Have you ever come across Civilizations by Laurent Binet? That's an attempt at the French name.
I haven't read this one. No, sorry.
It's a really interesting novel set probably around the same time, I think. But what they do is they say is he basically puts the idea that when the Spaniards went to South America and wiped out all the Incas and the Aztecs, instead what happened is they got killed, and then the Incas and Aztecs took their boats and sailed to Europe. And it gives an alternative history of Europe where the worship of the sun god and the Aztec religion takes over the whole of Europe. But there's all the same kind of political corruption and arranged marriages and people pretending to follow the religion for their own needs and stuff like that. And it ends with where the pyramid is at the Louvre. It ends up with a huge sacrificial human pyramid being built in that location because so many people have turned to this. But it's a great read from it because it teaches you a lot about it's written very much in the style of a kind of a chronicle from that time. So it teaches you lots of how normal people reacted to things and how the politics worked. But at the same time, you never for a moment think, oh, this is actually what the history was like. You know, it never blurs the line because it's obviously not true.
Yeah, I think that's what, you know, fantasy or even science fiction can offer when we discuss history, is discussing history and discussing what matters and the essence of some historical events, for example, without getting into the question of whether it was true or whether it's all a myth, or, well, as you said, you take the exact same bits of history, like the Napoleonic Wars, and you ask the French and the English, and you get two completely different versions of history, with each side pretending that their version is the right one. And that can get a little troublesome at times because, well, for example, Napoleon for us is a hugely important figure, and we tend to remember all the good he did, which, well, he did some good, but also forget that he was not only a dictator, he also crushed much of the French people under his heel, workers and women, and yeah, not to mention the rest of Europe.
So we don't learn anything good. We just learn that he lost and that he was short. That's really about all that we learn about. And he wasn't even short, as in but we learn that. Like, you, I only learned as an adult that he wasn't short. In school, I learned that he was short. Like,
yeah, and in France, we learn everything else. Basically, the Napoleonic Code and the, well, all his lawmaking, and of course how he tried to bring the ideas of the Enlightenment abroad to the rest of Europe and everything. So we learn the good sides without really learning that, for example, at the time when you were a factory worker, you needed a permit to go from one city to another. So it was basically back to the feudal system, but with factory owners as the new feudal lords, more or less. So rather dramatic. And yes, so that's why I tend to enjoy it when books take history and weave something different around historical events, but without pretending that they're telling the actual truth, because it allows to think a bit differently about things.
There's a book, I don't know if you come across the author, Ken Follett, a British author, the Pillars of the Earth series. Really, it rings a bell to what we're talking here. I think that it's set in the 12th century in a monastery, but it really you follow some monks and some, but also some, you know, very few of the people involved seem to have any kind of active religious kind of leaning for what they're doing. It's very much more about the kind of the empire building and then the political machinations. But it does teach you a lot about but the challenge is it teaches you a lot about key events. So it ends in this one event with this priest that we learn about in school called Thomas à Becket. But I've got no idea if what it teaches me about Thomas à Becket is actually some underlying truths and which bits of it are not true and have been fabricated. So that is the challenge of these things. Okay, so we've finished talking about the book, if that's okay. I don't know if there were any other recommendations you wanted to make about similar books.
Let me see. Well, one of my personal favorites when it comes to historical fantasy is the Lions of Orasan by Guy Gavrelki. And come to think about it, it's quite interesting to discuss in conversation with the accursed kings, because it takes this whole idea that history is about great men doing great things, etc., and thoroughly destroys it, you know, piece by piece, which is one of the things I love about Kay's books, actually, because he tends to see history much more in terms of people staying there, even after, for example, empires have crumbled, or there's been a war, or this city has fallen, this empire is no more, etc. And where history books would see the decline of empires, the fall of this or that, his books see people staying there, and they're still the same people, and they're working towards living their lives. And maybe rebuilding something, but mostly they keep existing. And it just establishes this idea that nobody gets to be a hero, a great man, and more important or valuable than everybody else. And I really like that, actually, because in history, I think this is a perspective we really, really need. This idea that we're all human beings, and some may happen to be at the top at a given moment, and some may happen to be a bit more gifted than others in some things or others. But at the end of the day, we all make a human contribution. And nobody gets to be treated as more valuable than others.
I heard on the radio the other day that around the time of Columbus, a name that you learn the name of Columbus in school. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, like we all learn Christopher Columbus. But around the time of that, they reckoned there were about 7 million people that lived in the equatorial rainforests in South America. Yep. 7 million, you know, and we all learn this one name, you know, and yet.
Exactly.
Just such a richness of human diversity that we miss out on there. Okay, well, we have had a good chat about the Accursed Kings, and now we've reached near the end of this podcast. I've been Chris Lowry. You can find out more about me as all about chris.org and various places. Where can we find out more about you, Cecile?
I have a website. I'm not on social media, I'm afraid, but I have a website. You can just Google my name, I think, and you'll find it. And otherwise, the name of the website is Stay Where People Sing. And so I have a bibliography there with a generally up-to-date list of my published stories.
Why is that the name of your website?
Oh, because it's a saying, I think, in Eastern Europe, stay where people sing, because bad people don't sing.
That is interesting.
I just like it.
Yeah, I the only issue with that, I think I'm gonna take is, given that we've been talking about, I'm pretty sure, didn't the Nazis use singing as a specific
Yes.
tool in their indoctrination?
Well, it's a saying, so obviously it's not true, but it's
Yeah,
pretty.
I do. No, but I definitely think if you find someone walking along the street having a hum, they're more likely to be they're like these a bit affable, you know, like and tell us about a little bit more about Elephants in Bloom, because obviously, you know, it's in my pile of books, so I've read it, but the rest of the listeners haven't, so.
It's a collection I put together working with Ian Waite from Newcomb Press. And so many of my stories, as I mentioned, are about the climate crisis or the environment one way or another. But I'm also really interested when it comes to talking about the climate crisis in just telling people, well, we worry about the future. And we are right to do so because we are not headed in a great direction, really. But I'm convinced that one of the things we should do is just stop and walk outside and look around us and really look around us at the world. You know, not necessarily can I afford this brand new SUV or what's interesting on my phone. Just look, there's a tree here, there's a flower there. And do I want to lose that? Do we want to lose that world? And so this is one thing I really want to focus on in my stories, looking around at what we do have and what's still there. And because if we don't have any motivation to preserve the world around us, we are not going to get anywhere. Yes, it's going to be all a big sacrifice. I can't drive my car any longer. I can't eat meat any longer. And what for? Just to preserve a forest next door? I don't even know it exists and I don't even care. Well, go out and see it and start caring. And
I went for a run yesterday. I help support some of the green spaces near my house. I went out for a run. I actually could probably show you. Where have we got? You can maybe see on my leg quite a lot of red dots.
oh.
And I went out for a run on this bit of green space, and I just got bitten by loads of bugs. And I got home, and my wife was like, "Well, that's probably because you were over there." And I was like, "Well, yeah, isn't it great that there's so many insects and there's such a rich biodiversity over there?"
Yes.
But I think most people wouldn't see getting bitten when you go on a walk as a positive.
Exactly. But the optimistic thing, though, is that I regularly take my students outside to do our classes outside, sitting in the grass. And usually, the first time they squeal and they say, oh, what's going on? A bug here, a spider there. And then they ask for more and more and more. And then by the end of the year, they just want to go out and sit in the grass. And they actually manage to focus.
Yeah,
So, yeah, so I think you can manage to
there's a lot to
develop
be
that.
said for pushing through on that stuff, isn't there? I did I helped lead a church in Warrington, and I did some stuff that involved breaking through some social barriers a little bit a while ago, and the feedback we got was amazing. We didn't like it. It made us feel uncomfortable. We know it was good for us, and we'd like you to do it again. You know, and there's not a lot of people self-aware enough to get past those first two, are there? But I think the more we can encourage all of us to do that, I think the better.
I think so, yeah. So that's what I'm trying to do in my stories, basically. Oh, not just talk about the future, but also talk about the present and the overlooked part of the world.
And the stuff we're losing, you know, potentially the
Yeah.
present that is here now that might not be here now. I mean, bugs are a real one. If you talk to people who've been
Yeah.
motorcycling for 30 or 40 years, they'll all say it used to be you needed to clean all of your visor of all the bugs when you
Yes.
finished, and now you can just go and you don't need to, which is terrifying madness. That's where we are. Thank you. Cecile, it's been wonderful talking to you. I'm glad we managed to connect again after EasterCon. Are you going to Worldcon?
Hopefully, let's just see how my finances are faring by that time, and but hopefully, yeah.
Well, we will see you there and Beyond Cataclysm. We'll have a stall there even. So thank you, everyone who's been listening. This has been a podcast from Beyond Cataclysm. If you enjoyed this, please listen to our other episodes. I think this is episode approximately 16 or 17 now. So we've had a whole range of amazing authors coming on talking about amazing books. Our other podcast, What is Roleplay, also looks at roleplay games from a completely beginner-friendly approach. And please do give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts, because then the magical algorithms will love us and everyone will know who we are or something. Our aim at Beyond Cataclysm is always to sustainably pay the people who work with us, to try and support charities where we can, and to just champion cool creative ideas. You can find out more about us at beyondcataclysm.co.uk. So thank you very much. Do you have any final thoughts for us, Cecile?
Not really, except, well, thank you so much for inviting me on this podcast. It was really fascinating to talk about this book with you and to exchange perspectives on history and everything. And hopefully the English and the French can be friends now.
I think so. I think we've resolved that. Thank you very much for being on the podcast. You've just listened to This Book I Read, starring me, CM Lowry, and Cecile Cristofari. Find out more about us, our podcast, opportunities for submissions to our projects, and more at beyondcataclysm.co.uk. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.